Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Isabel Campbell.
From here to there, it's not fair, but what is fair? Love if you dare. If you dare, as below, so above, it's not enough to bow to love. Bow to love. Bow to love.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. My guest in this episode was a founder member of Belle and Sebastian. There, for the band's very first album, the legendary Tiger Milk, her backing vocals, cello and keyboards helping define what would become the band's trademark sound. She then went on to become an acclaimed solo artist, first as The Gentle Waves, then under her own name. And she also worked on a series of brilliant and hugely loved collaborative albums with the late, great Mark Lanegan. And just this year, she released the gorgeous solo record, Bow to Love. Please welcome to The First Time, Isabel Campbell.
Bow to Love.
And I started by asking Isabel, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
Throwing myself around the room to Disney record that my parents had on the record player. I think that's my earliest. Like, I just went into it with great gusto and loved it, yeah.
What were the Disney tracks on there that were your key?
Like, Hi Ho, Hi Ho.
Big tune, like big tune. Yeah.
Like, I loved the Aristocats, the Everybody Wants to Be a Cat. I really liked The Ugly Bug Ball with Burl Ives. I was like, I want to go to that. So, yeah, that was my first memory.
Once a lonely caterpillar sat and cried to a sympathetic beetle by his side. I've got nobody to hug, I'm such an ugly bug. Then a spider and a dragonfly replied, if you're serious and want to win a prize, come along with us to the glorious annual Ugly Bug Ball. Come on, let's crawl, gotta crawl, gotta crawl to the Ugly Bug Ball, to the ball, to the ball, and a happy time we'll have there. One and all at the Ugly Bug Ball.
I was just like transported instantly.
Even from that age? I mean, so how old would you have been, do you think?
About four.
Right. Was it a musical household?
No, but both my parents love music. My mum can remember all the words, but when she sings, people say, please stop. my dad can't remember the words, but he can sing. He had all his like Led Zeppelin albums, Deep Purple, Rory Gallagher, all his like Stax 45s. Yeah, so they weren't musicians though, but they were really, they loved music.
Yeah. Was music like a special thing in the house? Because some people just kind of have it on in the background and that's fine. And other people are like, oh, it's time to put a record on. Family, assemble.
So I can remember my mum like blasting out Barbara Streisand, like the Black Widow.
Wow.
And she'd be like banging away, like making shortbread. And I'd be like scooped up, sat on the counter. But I remember just thinking, ooh, the Black Widow. I just really, I just thought that sounded mysterious.
The Black, Black Widow is sitting in the middle of the web. It's the fly she seeks. You may be her lover, but you never will recover. Cause she ain't had a bite for weeks. Why'd you think the widow's wearing black?
But it was just always there. We even had like a portrait of the Beatles in the house.
Really?
So like I remember just growing up and I just see like John Paul, George and Ringo every day over our dining table. They would like have parties because they're like both baby boomers and they would have parties and every week my dad would record the charts on a cassette and yeah. Then they would have like parties for the adults and so I kind of grew up with that.
I love the Beatles portraits. Like some people might have like the Queen or like a religious picture, but no, you had...
We did not have the Queen.
John Paul, George and Ringo.
Yeah. I was just like, they look like dads, so they must be all right. They just like... Because like when my parents were dating, like they'd go see the Stones, they saw Led Zeppelin, like they were just not musicians, but
they loved it.
Yeah, they really liked it.
So what was the first single or first thing that you owned or that was given to you? Because that first object always carries a lot of weight.
The first single was Taylor Dane, Tell It to My Heart.
Like, I remember that song.
Me and like Fiona McClellan, my little buddy, we got lit. It was like our first solo trip to Clydebank on the train, the two of us. And at the time, Boots the Chemist sold music.
I remember that as well. Oh, yeah.
And she was like, okay, I'll get the Kylie single. And I was like, okay, I'll get that. And we said we would swap
over.
But we never did.
Still bitter to this day.
But yeah, that was definitely the first single.
Yeah. And when did you realise that there was this connection between, oh, this is music that I love and transfixes me, but also maybe I could do something like that? Because that jump between Top of the Pops and the kid on the sofa gets a lot smaller when you realise that maybe it's something that you could do.
I never really thought I could do it. Like, I remember, like, being really young, and it was because it was, like, Heart of Glass was on Top of the Pops. I remember, like, being transfixed, like, who's she? Like, what's that? Like, I remember just kind of being, this is something I love,
right.
But I didn't necessarily think I could do it or whatever. But we had a piano teacher that stayed three doors up, and my granny had a piano in her hallway that I used to just like tinker around on, and I was always annoying everyone, like, can I get lessons? And then I just nagged everyone so much, and eventually I got to do that. And then later on, the cello teacher was back when I was at school, you could get lessons for free. So the cello teacher came into the class one day, like in primary five, and she played the Swan. And I thought, that's amazing.
Can you remember that moment?
Yeah, she was so elegant because she was like a really tall lady. She was a really cool lady. Like, she eventually became a Buddhist. And I remember just it sounded so elegant. And she'd like these long arms all wrapped around a cello. My little ears perked up. And I went home and went, can I do that? And I think they were probably like, why is she asking for all these things? I just like always been very into things. Like, if I'm drawn to something, I make it happen. So and the school even had cellos in the cupboard, and they just like brought one down, gave me it. And then they sort of said I was a natural. So even though I didn't really practice. But I never thought, just because I did that, didn't necessarily mean that I could...
You could be a musician.
I wasn't like, oh, no, I wasn't thinking that. I was probably not thinking much.
It's that funny thing, isn't it, growing up in that band of the 80s. The 80s was amazing for pop.
So
like,
good.
If you were in the 70s, there was like scruffy punk stuff. Oh, anyone can do that. And in the 90s, it was like, oh, there's scruffy people on stage. Anyone can do that. But in the 80s, it was pretty impossible to imagine being Madonna. Pop stars in the 80s seemed so
otherworldly. It was hard to imagine being Madonna, but I was like a little weirdo. Like, I really did think I came from outer space or something. Like, I would dress up as Boy George at Halloween. Like, I have the photographs.
Amazing.
The Karma Chameleon, me going to the Brownies Halloween party, and I looked like Boy George. And then later on, Madonna. And I looked like desperately seeking Susan era Madonna.
It's a good era.
It's a bit of a bizarre look for like a little kid though.
Yeah, this is true.
It looked a bit weird.
What was the first gig that you went to, the first concert?
The first concert was the Pixies at the SCCC.
That's a bit of a jump.
I know. I got in with these cool friends. One friend in secondary school, Meryl, and she was like really into metal. She was really into Judas Priest, David Lee Roth. Was all Kerrang, like all over her bedroom. And she loved music. And so I got a bit of a gig buddy. So we went to that Pixies. It was 1991.
Right.
I guess 15. And I think it was Cud, Teenage Fan Club, and the Pixies.
To see that tomorrow, totally.
It's not bad for a first.
Yeah.
Like we kind of got there, and I just felt like, yeah, I'm home. Like people were all like sat around on the ground waiting, and it just seemed like sort of sitting or some kind of happening, and I just thought, oh yeah, this is my tribe. Yeah, but then three songs in, the stage collapsed. The Pixies came on, and he said something like, "And blue as a pumpkin on Halloween," or something. And then three songs, and then disaster. So that was the first. It was quite scary because Meryl and I ended up like holding hands because the crowd was really like going, and we ended up getting separated, and like people got hurt, like people got injured at that thing, but she was okay and I was okay. And then it was a shame because I was 15 and I'd escaped for the night, and we had to call her mum's early because... like,
but you had that sense of like, this is where I'm supposed to be. Venues, these kind of people, wearing these kind of clothes in this kind of environment, in a dark...
Everything made sense to me.
Really?
Before, I don't think it really made much sense. Everything seemed sort of oppressive. It's just like, oh yeah, I know this.
So after that, where do your musical obsessions go?
Still felt like quite separate. Cello, piano, study.
Docs, band. Gigs, cider.
Exactly. But like Meryl was key. Like she was like my gig buddy. And a few months later, we went to the Playhouse to see Lou Reed in 92. That was like another one of my first solo trips.
How was that?
I was like, I'm going. Try and stop me, you know, put on my mum's... stole her leather trousers. Really bad for him. He seemed really grumpy.
Natch.
Makes adds up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I was happy because he played Satellite of Love and it was Lou Reed. Like,
probably played the songs that didn't really sound like the original versions, but at least it's him singing.
A lot of it didn't sound anything like anything.
Satellite's gone up to the skies. Like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Satellite of love. Satellite of love. Satellite of love. Satellite's gone way up to Mars. Soon it'll be filled with park and cars. I watched it for a little while. I love to watch things on TV. You've been bold with Harry, Mark, and John. Monday and Tuesday, Wednesday through Thursday with Harry, Mark, and John. Satellite's gone up to the skies. Things like that drive me out of my mind. It for a little while. I love to watch things on TV. Satellite of love. Satellite of love. Satellite of love. Satellite of love.
But I think bands like Teenage Fan Club and like the Pastels were key because Oh, that's so good. These people live where I live, and these people are like some of the coolest people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, the Vaselines and Primal Scream. And so that was sort of going on.
So where does it start? Where's the route to becoming the first Belle and Sebastian stuff? Where's the route into that then for you?
So like the Pixies, then, you know, the Lou Reed concert. Then my parents had friends, Lillian and Uncle Bert around the corner. Her sister had a very cool Kenny Little. Like, he made a record recently, actually. Like, he's an art teacher, but he's also a musician. So my ears pricked up again. I was like, oh, guitar lessons, guitar lessons. And so every Saturday morning, I'd go around to his house and he'd just talk about music and art, Joni Mitchell, John Lennon, like everything. It's like I've fallen into a tub of butter again. But I think when I was like, oh, Teenage Fan Club, oh, and then go and see the BMX Bandits, like, oh, so-and-so's mates with them. And then it just kind of all the dots kind of joined up. I just like start meeting other musicians. And then when people would hear I'm a cellist, they'd say, oh, will you play cello on our song and everything? So it just all kind of grew and grew and grew. And eventually someone through that, I met Stuart at like a New Year's party that I actually think it was a party for Alex Chilton.
Wow, that's cool.
So I went to the New Year party and everyone was buzzing because like, oh, Alex Chilton or whatever. But that's where I met Stuart.
And the early Belle and Sebastian, everyone loves to sort of mythologize things, especially when those things go on to become something that they love, the sort of the early seeds of it. But it seemed so, I think you'd say organic now, wouldn't you?
We sort of banned that word. Like, I remember when we got flown to New York and they would always talk about the music being organic and everyone
it's a horrible word. But like, I wasn't going to say haphazard, but so unpretentious and so just self-driven. There wasn't any outside, aside from the little world that it came from. Nothing else really seemed to matter.
Just seemed like it was meant to be, like, everything lined up, you know, like sometimes just nothing lines up. But for that, things just kept growing and in the right direction. It wasn't an accident, though, because like Stuart had worked hard, you know, he's really crafted it. And but I think just how everyone hooked up and it was all kind of like word of mouth and so-and-so knows so-and-so. Even like my best friend now, like, I met her when I was 18, the first time we played at a house party on Renfrew Street in Glasgow, and she held the microphone for me. She was at art school. I'm not sure why it worked or why it came together.
But it just did.
It did, yeah. But I mean, the two Stuarts, they had kind of thought about it.
They knew what it wanted to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's like about the only thing they probably knew. Like, but I mean, I think that's the main thing too, Noel. Like,
yeah,
they were very set on the aesthetic and the sound.
Can you remember Tiger Milk first coming out?
Oh, yeah. I remember thinking, what's really happening? It did seem sort of like the stuff of fairy tales in a way. Because it was, first of all, it was like supposed to be a single. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm so not going to uni this week. And I'm like,
this is over.
Bye. I was like, yep, I'm going in the studio. And then, so it was supposed to be like a single or something. And then it was like, oh, by the way, we're actually making it an album now. Honestly, it was the best thing ever.
Lisa knows a girl who's been abused. She changed her philosophy in 82. She's always looking for a fight. She keeps the neighbors up all night. I go to her when I'm feeling slack. The girl's using me as a punching bag. I think that I can have her right. But the girl's got a lot to be mad about. But in the first moment I'm waking up, she knows she's easy in there. She's easy in there. And when the first cup of coffee tastes like washing up, she's losing it.
boys and the girls with gold. Chelsea was the one that's been abused. You changed her philosophy in 82. She says inch for inch and pound for pound. Who needs boys when there's Lisa around? But in the first moment of awakening up, she knows she's losing it. Oh yeah, she's losing it. And when the first cup of coffee gets her washing up, she knows she's losing it.
Six Music at All Points East Festival.
This weekend, Six Music is back at All Points East Festival.
We've handpicked a lineup of incredible artists and DJs for our very own Six Music stage.
Friday afternoon from 4, Hugh Stevens will be live on site.
I'll be down there soaking up the atmosphere and speaking to some of the incredible artists performing in Victoria Park.
Then Nathan Shepherd has a special Indie Forever from 9 p.m.
I'll be playing all the indie bangers you love live from backstage.
Plus, you can listen back to highlights on BBC Sounds. Just search All Points East.
Six Music at All Points East Festival.
Matt Everett's The First Time with Isabel Campbell.
Six. Music.
When I was much younger, you used to have to seek out records. If you wanted like a certain Revolver Underground record ever, you'd have to go to a certain secondhand record shop.
Yes.
And maybe they might have one, and then maybe they won't. That's kind of what I remember from when I was like 14, 15. And then jump forward years to Tiger Mug, because it was finding someone that had a copy or someone that had a cassette, because you couldn't just get hold of it. It was quite a difficult thing.
Yeah, you should have been at the launch party, because it was like wallpapering the walls of the church studio. Like, it was people were just like running around using it as frisbees. Seriously.
Why do you think it worked? Because obviously after that, the band find their way into people's hearts. People start to really connect with Band of Sebastian. What is it about them, do you think?
It's got to be the songs, hasn't it? The songs, the instrumentation. Also, timing is everything, you know? Like, I think it was the right time, because I remember when I heard the demos, I thought, oh, because Simon Shaw, who worked in Missing Records, he'd heard some of my songs and he was like, you should meet Stuart. And I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. But then I heard Stuart's demo and I thought, oh, I would go and see that band and I would like be into them and follow them around if I wasn't in them.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? If you become a musician, then no one can really sort of prepare you for what it's going to be actually like. It's like, okay, well, this may be something you've dreamed of, or something you've been working towards, and now all of a sudden you are on a transit, you're in a hotel, you're in Amsterdam, you're doing this stuff, and it all becomes, it's your life.
Yeah.
And some people take to it like a duck to water, other people find it quite difficult, other people find ways of dealing with it and coping mechanisms.
Yes.
Because it's a very unusual way of living your life as an artist. How do you think you dealt with it?
I don't think I dealt with it great, to be honest. I feel like I got overwhelmed a lot and just constantly overwhelmed, but really liked it at the same time, but was also afraid a lot of the time.
What do you mean by afraid?
It was such a unlikely thing to happen. Like, how many people does that happen to?
Exactly.
But then at the same time, for me personally, it felt like just being thrown in like a cold bath. But not in a bad way, if that makes sense. It was just like full on. It was full on. And like the earliest days were the funnest days for me. And then when it got very serious, which is like, why shouldn't it be serious? But sometimes it got a bit heavy because people feel the pressure, don't they? Like, also when people get a taste of success, it's like a drug, isn't it? It's like more, more, more. There's all these things at play. But it was amazing. But it was, I think, honestly, I'm still processing it now. I'll probably be processing it till I pop off, you know?
Yeah. Even just the basic element of, if you're playing shows and you're going out and maybe 200, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 people every night, they're focused on you and they're expecting, but then enjoying and then reflecting that back at you, which is a lovely thing to experience. Oh, people telling you you're great, what you just did was brilliant, do more of that. That's a very strange psychological, a wonderful kind of contract to have with an audience.
I think sometimes we struggle to know, well, I know I struggle to know what parts of it to own, what is my role in this, and right. Yeah, it probably would have been better if I'd been like off my head on drugs, but I wasn't. I was just,
it probably
I was,
wouldn't have been better.
No, it no. wouldn't. It wouldn't. But like, I think that's why people do just release the pressure that way. But yeah, no, it was great, but it was also weird. And then also you'd get like other bands, like peers, there'd be like a sort of resentful feel because there's this competitive. Yeah, it was all sorts of everything. And because there was a lot of us, there was eight people. Like, that's
complex.
Yeah, well, I think so. But not to be sniffed at the same time. I'm really lucky. And
yeah.
Is it wicked not to care when they say that you're mistaken, thinking hopes is lots of dreams that aren't there? Is it wicked not to care when you've wasted many hours talking endlessly to anyone that's there? I know the truth away. Skipping tickets, making rhymes, is that all that you believe in? Wearing rags to make you pretty by design. Rusting armor for effect, it's not fun to watch the rust grow, for it will all be over when you're dead.
Your first solo album, or the Gentle Waves record, it's 1999. What were the music that you were listening to that kind of informed that record?
I think I was just like dying to make a record, just to be creative. I didn't really have like a grand plan. I was kind of just like growing up in public. I just wanted to get in the studio and play around and get the tapes going and do stuff. But then it was almost like it will get released. Like, oops. Yeah, it's, I just really like creating things. Always have, always will, probably. And yeah, I was definitely learning as I went. And yeah. For my stuff, I wasn't really sure what I was doing, to be honest, because there was no...
There was no plan.
Just have a bash. That was the plan, which isn't really a plan.
Yeah, no, it's as good a plan as any.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't like, oh, this is how it's going to go down. Like, I was just like, what?
And how was it going from being one of an ensemble to being like, there's one face on this cover, the spotlights are pointing in one direction most of the time?
It was strange because it was really different to the being part of a collective. Like, the group thing was safer, but I think, like, creatively, I just wanted to kind of experiment and sort of dabble about, really. But lots of people would do that and they just wouldn't release. Like, that's the scary part. Like, oh, God. But, oh, well. I feel like I would spend so much time in the studio, and a lot of the early records, it was almost like putting myself through learning the ropes, learning about what you can actually do in the studio and experimenting. Yeah.
I don't think, no matter how far you get down the line or however good or famous or successful or critically revered you get, you're learning something every time. You should be, right?
Yes.
And the record is that moment. It's not, oh, this as you say, there's a perfect thing that I'm trying to make. No, I'm just making the thing that I am making now.
Yeah, and I'd just be like expressing thoughts that I had or trying to say something that I thought I might like to say. And then every record it would be like, oh, well, I won't do that again. It's like a different mistake. It's just like a total learning that never, it just keeps going, yeah. Really.
Something to eat. Still water, still run deep. The dogs are barking now. Get back out on the street.
Tell me about first meeting Mark Lanigan. When was the first time you crossed paths with him?
I was really always obsessed with Nancy and Lee, and I just loved Lee Hazelwood's songs and writing and everything. And I was kind of looking for someone with a baritone voice, and my boyfriend at the time said, you should ask Mark to sing. And I just went, okay. And then so I just sent a demo. Then a month later or something, the guy that was managing me at the time was like, oh, Mark wants to phone you. And so I was like, okay. And then he'd like sang it down the phone to me.
Yeah, it was as easy as that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yes. But he collaborated with so many people. Like, that was the thing that he did. Like, he just collaborated nonstop.
What was the first session like that you did together? Can you remember that?
So the first record we made via FedEx. Mm-hmm. And then we had some redos. And he was still kind of like in rehab. So he got like a day release or something. And I flew out to LA like for like about 5 or 6 days. And he was just like sat in a chair with frozen peas or something because he'd done a shoulder in or something. And I was just jet lagged. And like I knew that they were all laughing at me because like the... Because they're all like these gnarly rockers and I'm like this Bambi or something. And I knew that they were laughing at me, but oh well. But stuff was going on because it was at the beginning of him starting to get his stuff together. And we were like finishing the first record. So I was in LA for that. And then he just like disappeared off the planet. And I thought, oh, you know, like, I remember I was painting in my kitchen, painting the cupboard doors or something, and when the radio was about the news with Elliot Smith, and I remember thinking after Mark dropped off the face of the earth, I remember thinking, oh God, like one day that might be what is gonna go down or whatever. But no, he disappeared, and then the album came out and he was disappeared, and I thought, well, that's the album, like it's just like disappeared. And like we got Mercury nominated, and
I remember,
and he disappeared. So I like showed up at that on my own, feeling very much like half of something. And I just thought, oh well, probably won't ever see him again. And the album came out in like January 2006. Then November 2006, I just wake up one morning and there's this message on my answer phone, just going like, it's Mark Lanigan. I'm in Glasgow. You want to come to the show? And I was like, meh. I remember hearing it. I was like, I am not going to that show. And then, of course, I went. He was playing at Oremore, and I went, and he'd gotten clean. And we went across to the piano bar afterwards, and he said, I want to tour. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Like, you just literally disappear for years.
Yeah, like I just thought I would never, like, I thought I'd never see him again. So like when he showed up like almost a year later and I was like, do you want to tour? I was just like, wow, okay. And I was like, I didn't even know if we could tour, like chops shut, you know. But I had a really good tour manager at the time. And him and I got on really well, and he really helped me bring that together. We did our first concert in 2007 at Celtic Connections, and I mean, I was like absolutely terrified, but we did it, and it was worth the wait.
Because I know people that saw those shows, and I know people that love those records, and people really do. They mean something.
They meant a lot to me. Like, I mean, I had self-funded that first record.
Did you?
And like, yeah. I'd like run out of money, and I'd be like, okay, record on pause, and then I get paid again, and then I'd be like, okay, now I can get the string players in. And because I was like, as well though, I want to make this record for me. I didn't want to make it for a label and be like, well, even if it's really stinky, out it goes. Like, I just wanted to
own it, make it about you, for you.
I was making the record for me.
Yeah.
And just learning, and so it was so good, like when we got the vocals back from him, and like we were listening to the vocals for like Circus is Leaving Town, and it just sounded so good. I was really excited. Yeah.
Can you remember where you were when you first heard that he died?
I was at my mum's house. I had been writing all day. Really weird. So I hadn't listened to a baritone singer for so long. And then the day that he died, I'd been really weird. I'd sort of been writing this song called You, and then also for some weird reason, I don't even know why, I kept listening to that Leonard Cohen song, Anthem. What's it? Ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering, there is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. And it was a really strange day, and I was listening to that all day. And then at 7 o'clock or 7:30 that night, the call came in. It was really strange. And then I was up till about 5 that night, because it was just like, I mean, I hadn't seen him for years. Mm. But it's just so final, you know.
We never know when something's going to be the last time.
The birds, they sing at the break of day, again. I heard them say, don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be cut again. Bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Asked for signs, the signs were sent. The birth betrayed, the marriage spent. Yeah, the widowhood of every government. Signs were all to see. Can't run no more with that lawless crowd, while the killers in high places say their prayers out loud. But they've summoned up a thundercloud. They're gonna hear from me. But still to bring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Strike up the march. There is no drum. Every heart to love will come. But like a refugee, ring the bells that still. Thank you.
Tell me about Bow to Love.
What do you want to know?
Before that, first day putting it down. It's all about first, isn't it? Did you have an idea of what you wanted it to be?
No, not really. I knew the title because, like, I didn't actually have the album finished at all. And I went and met the label and they were like, when will you have the record? Like, I went and met them in the August and I was like, I'll have it to you in a month. And
I'll send it to you this afternoon when I finish writing and recording it.
And they were like, oh, what's it called? And I was like, Bow to Love. But then a lot of the albums write themselves with whatever is going on at that time.
Of course.
And like recently I've heard that somebody say that we teach what we most need to learn. And I really think like I've been learning so much about relationships and communication and just trying to undo stuff. So that's really like where I'm at. And it means a lot to me. With me though, what comes out, comes out. So I wasn't really sure what it would be, but it kind of came together.
Was there one song that kind of unlocked the record? One song that you got right and you were like, okay, I know.
Not really. Like, right. It took quite a while. Like, it was quite sort of staggered and there was lots of things like starting in like 2016, which I started writing and didn't really finish writing till like 2022.
It's quite a long time.
Yeah. So I'd start things and then not really know where to go. But then by the time I was like, okay, I really need to have this record in now. For some reason, whatever had been going on in my life and everything, things just kind of came together. I'd sort of really like escaped into Mark. It was like writing for Mark was a way of like I could communicate, but not necessarily own things, yeah. You know? So he always used to say when we'd perform like the really stripped down acoustic songs, he'd be like, ah, feel like I'm butt naked. And so when I came to do Back on My Own, it's like I felt very like head on the chopping block. I'd still happily write for others. So, and just actually the Humanist record came out, I'm on that.
Show me why.
so we wrote together on that. And he was like reading down the phone to me. He was like, "Ah, oh, people like our song." And I'm like, "Yay." And so I was like, "I'd write with you again." I said, "I don't have to sing it." Like, you know what I mean? Like, I actually do like writing for different voices, and I actually can, which I don't even know how I can, but I can.
And the final question, which is, we ask everyone to pick the final record. What should we play out on?
No, I'm really on the spot.
Yeah. It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a real bugger. Hey. What about Francois Hardy? I mean, she just passed, didn't she?
Yeah.
That long ago. And she's one of the reasons why I sing, so...
Let's finish with that one.
Okay.
It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next in line for heartaches? Who'll make the same mistakes I made over you? Who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next in line for you? Who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next to watch your love fade? All your affections finally fade away. There'll be no use in saying, who'll be the next in line for you? If you love, who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next in line for heartaches? Who'll make the same mistakes I made over you? Who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next in line for you? One day you'll find out when I'm gone, I was the best one you had. I was the one who gave you love. Who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next to watch your love fade? All your affections finally fade away. There'll be no use in saying, who'll be the next in line for you? For you.
That was Francois Hardy, Who Will Be the Next in Line, written by Ray Davis from The Kinks. And that's the final choice of my guest, Isabel Campbell. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Lucy Rose. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows, including my conversations with Boy George, Bernard Butler and Karine Bailey-Ray. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.